Are you stressed? Have restless nights? Racing thoughts? We've all been there. Imagine having a natural way to feel calmer, sleep better, and bring more balance into your day. That's exactly what CBD can do. And when it comes to CBD, nobody does it better than CBDFX. CBDFX has been around since 2014, and they're one of the most trusted CBD companies out there. Every product is made right here in the USA with organic hemp, no GMOs, no pesticides, and no harmful chemicals. Plus, everything is backed by third-party lab reports, so you know it's pure, safe, and effective. They've got something for everyone, from sleep gummies and tinctures to CBD capsules, topicals, and even CBD treats for your pets. So it's easy to find the perfect fit for you. Their products have become part of my daily routine, and honestly, they just help calm my nerves. Improving sleep has led to so many other benefits. I can think more clearly. I have more energy. The podcast is better, probably, I think it is. You tell me. I've spoken before about my personal favorite, the CBD and CBN night capsules for sleep, which help you fall asleep quickly and sleep soundly through the night. They contain CBN, cannabinoid, commonly known as the ultimate relaxation cannabinoid, and other natural sleep aids. They're vegan, gluten-free, and made with organic hemp. So whether you want calm, focus, better sleep, or just an overall wellness boost, CBDFX has something for you. And right now, our listeners can get 40% off of your first order with code HAUNTINGS at CBDFX.com. That's CBDFX.com. Use promo code HAUNTINGS and get 40% off today. Feel the difference with CBDFX.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
It's not exactly the sound of the bells ringing on Christmas Day, is it? But that noise is the sounds of an American Christmas. Or at least it was at one time. You see, whenever you hear someone talk about an old-fashioned traditional Christmas, I can promise you that this doesn't mean what they think it does. Unless you were wealthy, a traditional American Christmas meant drunken rowdies prowling the streets, banging on pots and pans, playing drums, blowing horns and whistles, shooting off firecrackers, firing guns, and making as big of a racket as possible. It was a time of all-day drinking and hell-raising. Masked people, most of them young men, entered houses without invitation, sang bawdy songs, and performed little skits. In return, they demanded food, drink, or money, and threatened broken windows or worse unless they got it. It was sort of like an old-fashioned version of the Purge. Usually without all the murder. Usually. But no matter what, it was a time of public feasting, gluttony, and drunkenness, when revelers celebrated with brandy, rum, wine, gin, whiskey, and homemade beer. It was so wild that Christmas was even banned for years by none other than the Puritans. You know, those fun folks who brought us the New England witch trials. They considered the celebration of Christmas to be too sinful. So just remember when you hear some fundamentalist religious group or right-wing commentator harping about a war on Christmas, the only people to ever ban Christmas were Christians. Although, let's be honest, nothing that I've described sounds like the kind of traditional Christmas that most people think of. But it was the Christmas season of colonial America, before Santa Claus, decorating trees, holiday shopping, quiet family dinners, and all the other things we associate today with the holidays. Christmas was a public celebration in the streets and in the pubs. Few people celebrated in church, and even fewer celebrated with family at home. And for good reason. The winter nights were cold and dark. It was a time of snow, ice, and being trapped indoors with that same family. The coming days and weeks were going to be spent around the fire waiting for better weather to return. that fire, along with candles and oil lamps, were the only way to stay warm and to keep away the shadows that were creeping outside your door. This made it the perfect time for stories and storytelling, especially stories of ghosts, hauntings, spectral travelers, and the night folk. In those days, the cold winter months were considered the spookiest time of the year. It was a dark season that began with Halloween and lasted until the spring thaw. In centuries past, the holiday season was not just a time of celebration. It was also a time to be afraid. So if you've ever wondered why the lyrics mention scary ghost stories and that song, "The Most Wonderful Time of the Year," well, now you know. Winter had always been the season of death, and a time filled with malicious spirits, demons, witches, and other threatening entities. That was the reason why the early American revelers rang bells, blew horns, and banged pots and pans together. They were scaring away the monsters and the ghosts. And you might also drink too much if you had to venture into the darkness with such creatures on the prowl. A dark winter's night just might be your last night on Earth if you took the wrong path home to get home after spending the evening at the pub. But the holiday season the colonists celebrated had far older roots than the 17th and 18th centuries. Those roots dated back to the pagan celebrations of Yule, the celebrations the church had tried to wipe out and replace with their own. And it would be from this complicated mess that our American traditions would eventually emerge, causing more chaos, fear, and outright terror than most of us can imagine, especially when it comes to Christmas. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. But in celebration of the season, this episode will be a little bit different. Instead of chasing the devil through American history, we're going to take a look at how the fear of ghosts, devils, and witches gave us the American Christmas season we all know today. So get ready for what I hope will be a wild and entertaining ride. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And thanks for joining me for Episode 6, A Very Scary Christmas. While most Americans today can't imagine Christmas without Santa Claus, Christmas trees, hanging stockings, and all the other things I mentioned earlier, most of those traditions didn't start until the 19th century, and with the blending of many different cultures. When English settlers first came to America's shore, they of course brought their beliefs and traditions with them, including those of Christmas, such as they were at the time. Those beliefs and traditions soon became controversial, and those who lived throughout the colonies fiercely disagreed about how to celebrate Christmas or whether to celebrate it at all. And don't worry, they'd all been fighting about this long before they ever got here. In the late 1500s, the Puritans had started bullying people in England, trying to purify the Church of England and erase all the Catholic traditions they believed were still lurking within it. And that included Christmas, which they knew had pagan roots in the Roman winter festival of Saturnalia and in the Norse festival of Yule. At that time, celebrations of Christmas in England lasted nearly 2 weeks, from the designated day of Christ's birth on December 25th to Twelfth Day on January 6th, and consisted of rowdy celebrations that included feasting, drinking, gambling, and masquerade balls. In America, the celebration of Christmas really depended on the region where one settled. As you might imagine, living in Puritan New England was about as much fun at Christmas time as it was at any other time of year. That is to say, not fun at all, unless you enjoy spending every day doing nothing but praying and working. Christmas celebrations were frowned upon and harshly discouraged. In fact, many believed that Christmas was a day that the Puritans saved their greatest contempt for, and were shocked and offended by anyone who dared to celebrate it. For the Puritan separatist sect that we call the Pilgrims, it was just another working day. Governor William Bradford noted in his diary that the colonists began building the Plymouth settlement's first house on December 25, 1620. The following year, when a group of newly arrived settlers refused to work on Christmas Day, Bradford gave them a pass until they could become, quote, better informed. But he drew the line at allowing them to play games while everyone else worked. He wrote, "If they made the keeping of Christmas a matter of devotion, let them keep to their houses. There should be no gaming or reveling in the streets." The Puritans gained even more power in the colonies after the bitterness between the Puritans and the Anglicans back in Europe led to the First English Civil War in 1642. After that, the Puritans came into power and they banned the celebration of Christmas, Easter, and various saints' days. In their strict views, only the Sabbath day was sacred. Any holiday with pagan roots was unacceptable. The Massachusetts Bay Colony followed this example. According to a law passed in 1659, a fine would be imposed on anyone who might be, quote, found observing any such day as Christmas, either by forbearing of labor, feasting, or in any other way. Any continued celebration would lead to arrest. Puritan ministers preached viciously against the celebration of the holiday, seeing no scriptural reason for celebrating it. The fact that it had pagan roots proved it was worthy of contempt. Infamous minister Cotton Mather even said that Christ was dishonored more during the 12 days of Christmas than during any of the preceding 12 months of the year. So, as the Puritans loved to do, they took anything they wanted their followers to avoid and made it scary. Ironically, when they tried to frighten the people away from Christmas, they tapped into the holiday's pagan roots to do so. Those 12 days of Christmas between December 25th and January 6th widely became known as the Season of the Witch. It was a time when spirits and supernatural creatures roamed the earth. The early church had claimed that witches and threatening spirits appeared in the sky, and dark forces roamed the earth with plans of evil because they were unhappy about the celebration of Christ's birth. To the Puritans, though, these dark spirits reveled in it. They pointed to the traditions of the past, when January 6th, which the church had turned into Epiphany, had been the holy night of Bershta, goddess of winter, animals, and witchcraft. In those days, witches were praised for watching over the spirits of dead children, and families who suffered such losses placed offerings outside their doors at night. One of the most common offerings was goose fat, left over from the traditional holiday dinner. It was believed that witches rubbed their body with goose fat mixed with other ingredients so they could fly through the night to their sabbats. But as we know, there was little the Puritans feared more than witches and witchcraft. The mere idea of them roaming the countryside was enough to make everyone lock their doors and devise other ways to keep the evil away, like keeping a fire burning in the fireplace so that witches couldn't come down the chimney, or hiding brooms so that witches couldn't ride on them. Witches who traveled by night were in league with the devil, they were told. They weren't caring for dead children, they were eating them or sacrificing them to their dark lord. It was easy for Puritan leaders to convince their followers that witches and Christmas went hand in hand, complicating the celebration of the season for many years to come. And that complication would continue even after the end of the English Civil Wars and the monarchy was restored. After that, Massachusetts gave in to growing pressure and repealed some of its most restrictive laws, including the ban on Christmas. Even so, Puritan opposition to Christmas remained strong throughout the colonial period. Thanks to this, its popularity was slower to catch on than it was in the rest of the country. Businesses remained open on December 25th, and Massachusetts didn't officially recognize the holiday until the middle of the 19th century. But despite Puritan efforts, once colonists started to celebrate Christmas, they embraced it with enthusiasm. They imported English customs like feasting, drinking, and wassailing, which was the tradition of traveling between homes, drinking and singing while passing around bowls of spiced ale or mulled wine. It was, I don't know, drunk Christmas caroling, I guess, which meant singing popular English favorites like The First Noel and God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. And then there were the mummers. This tradition involved people dressing up in costume and going from house to house, asking if the mummers are allowed in. Once inside, they played music, sang, danced, performed plays, and drank while their hosts were encouraged to try and guess their identities before they moved on to the next house. The tradition was always meant to be fun and harmless, but in the late 18th century, a rowdy gang of Christmas revelers called the Antics began menacing high society Boston. Their version of mumming took on an aggressive tone. They invited themselves into the homes of Boston's wealthiest families, and after concluding their performance, they didn't accept the traditional gift of food and drink. They demanded cash instead. At any other time of year, they might have been jailed for robbery and home invasion, but at Christmas, the family suspended their expectations about respect for social superiors. However, they quietly put an end to mumming in the city, and the passion for the tradition cooled to the point that it mostly disappeared from America's version of Christmas. The Puritans were not alone in their dislike of Christmas. The Quakers in Pennsylvania, yes, again, another religious group, were also opposed to the celebration of the holiday for all the same reasons the Puritans were. But the Quakers were eventually outnumbered, and the mid-Atlantic colonies began to fill with settlers of other faiths who not only had no opposition to Christmas, but who wanted to enjoy and celebrate the day. This region was home to a variety of groups and cultures, and at first, the traditions and customs of the holiday differed according to where people lived. The Dutch, the Germans, and the French celebrated in their own ways, as did the English, who helped to spread the idea of a common celebration among the various Protestant faiths of the area. But no matter how those who embraced Christmas tried, they couldn't convince everyone to take part in the celebration. In those days, the pagan roots of the winter season were a little too recent for comfort, and ministers encouraged their congregations to refrain from revelry. Well, they did until those parishioners began looking for churches that weren't so strict when it came to Christmas. They wanted to celebrate like other churches did, and slowly, the anti-Christmas rules began to relax. This was likely not because the ministers had a change of heart about Christmas. It was more likely because they were afraid of losing their congregations. Regardless of why it happened, though, as more settlers were exposed to Christmas celebrations, the number of those who began to observe the holiday grew by leaps and bounds. Except for in the colonial South. That was another story altogether. But a good one. It was in the southern colonies where Christmas flourished from the very start, dating back to the arrival of the Jamestown settlers in 1607. Christmas was an important holiday to them, even though their early celebrations were limited by the harsh realities of life in the struggling community. Christmas was reserved as a day of rest, by law, in Virginia. And by the 1630s, law stated that churches were to be built in areas that needed them before the Christmas celebration arrived. The holiday became a major part of winter life in the South during colonial and revolutionary America. The celebrations were, of course, much different from the ones we know today, but were always festive events. One festive tradition that has mercifully faded over the years was the firing of muskets and cannons in celebration. It was a custom that could be unnerving for those who didn't know it was coming. One visitor to a Virginia plantation wrote, "I was waked up this morning by guns fired all around the house. It was a moment of pure terror." For this man, who may have been unfamiliar with the holiday tradition of firing guns at Christmas, this was a startling way for the holiday to begin. But men throughout the southern colonies made a habit of firing guns at Christmas, often to the dismay of the authorities who worried about the dangers of flying bullets. And like the racket of the morning, there were no silent nights at Christmas. Respectable folks sang carols, played games, performed plays, and danced to music. In places like Virginia, dancing in the summer could be unpleasantly hot, so Christmas became the perfect time to plan a grand party. This meant musicians had to be hired, cooks put to work, and dressmakers were secured months in advance. For one holiday ball, a family hired fiddlers, a jester, a tightrope walker, and an acrobat to entertain family and friends. For those who couldn't afford such extravagance, Christmas was a time for excessive drinking. No matter how rich or poor a family might be, copious amounts of alcohol were purchased, brewed, distilled, and bottled. One visitor to the home of a Virginia relative wrote that, quote, "There was good wine and all kinds of beverages, so there was a good deal of carousing." While celebrations varied throughout the South, we know that both Thomas Jefferson and George Washington celebrated Christmas. After the Revolution, Jefferson mentioned his grandson joyfully exclaiming "Merry Christmas" in an 1809 letter, while a younger Jefferson had referred to the day as, quote, "one of the greatest mirth and jollity," in a letter he wrote in 1762. In George Washington's case, we know that he celebrated Christmas, even if we don't have the details about his family's celebrations. We know he observed the 12 days of Christmas and was married to his wife Martha on January 6th, the day that marked the Feast of Epiphany. Washington also participated in fox hunts, which were common in Virginia as part of the holiday festivities. But we also know he didn't celebrate every year, because during the Revolutionary War, fighting didn't stop for the holiday, and the soldiers were exchanging gunfire, not gifts. And then, of course, there was the famous Christmas when Washington crossed the Delaware River for an attack on Trenton, New Jersey. For the most part, though, fighting did slow down during the winter season, not because of Christmas, but because of the weather. Joseph Martin, a Continental Army soldier who wrote a memoir about his service during the war, noted the arrival of Christmas only as a way to mark time. No celebration was mentioned. Though Christmas had become a relatively mainstream celebration by the time of the Revolutionary War, it still wouldn't be officially recognized as a holiday for years. In fact, in 1789, Congress went so far as to hold its first session on Christmas Day. No big deal. But official or not, Christmas slowly seeped into the American imagination. The Christmas season began to be packed with parties, feasts, hunts, balls, and church services. People decorated homes with evergreen plants such as holly, ivy, mountain laurel, and mistletoe, a favorite of couples seeking a holiday kiss. It would take nearly a century for Congress to declare Christmas a national holiday, which it finally did in 1870. By that time, traditions such as the Christmas tree, Santa Claus, and gift-giving had become a part of the season, turning what had once been a season of darkness and death and terror into one of joy and light. And that's always been the reason why, when terrible things occur during the holiday season, we find ourselves more shocked and saddened by the tragedies, deaths, and disasters than we might be at another time of the year. When the whistle blew at the Norton Iron Works in the Ohio River town of Ashland, Kentucky, it didn't mean just the end of the workday. It was also the start of the Christmas holiday. It was December 23rd, 1881, and Christmas was only 2 days away. It was the time of year that brought out the best in everyone. Hearts were filled with joy and generosity, and it was the time of year when even the most hardened men found some semblance of happiness. For some, the holiday season meant family, food, and festive gatherings, while for others, it meant a celebration of the birth of Christ. But a mother named Martha Gibbons didn't find peace, joy, or happiness that Christmas. The only gift she received that year was soaked in blood. For Martha and the people of Ashland, a horrific tragedy occurred that altered the celebration of the holidays for decades to come. Martha was born and raised in the part of Virginia that would become West Virginia after the Civil War. Her father, Joseph Rhodes, had settled on the land years earlier after immigrating to America. She was only a teenager when she met John Gibbons, a man almost two decades her senior, but she quickly fell in love. Martha's family, especially her father, was unhappy with the match. John was too old and they knew nothing about him. Martha, though, ignored their protests. John was handsome, had a little money, and said all the right things. When he proposed, Martha immediately agreed to be his wife. The couple moved to Point Pleasant, Virginia, soon after the wedding. John was elected town marshal, and his carpentry skills were rewarded with a contract to build the new county jail. The couple began to prosper, and they started a family. But as the new jail neared completion, it burned down. With his hard work in ruins, John moved his family west to Missouri, where he worked a small parcel of land. And again, they prospered, but this was interrupted by his service during the Civil War. When John returned home from the Confederate military, he found that his land had been confiscated while he was away. Dejected, the family returned to what is now West Virginia for a time, and then finally moved to Ashland, Kentucky. They settled into a part of town known as Geiger's Addition, or East Ashland, in a cramped one-and-a-half-story house rented from a local merchant named C.C. Geiger. They lived in the crowded cottage with their three youngest children, Sterling, who was 11, Fanny, who was a young woman at 14, and Robert, 17, an industrious young man who worked as a nail feeder at the Norton Iron Works. He provided most of the income for the impoverished family. Robert was likable and admired, especially by the men who worked with him, mostly because he did everything with just one leg. A decade earlier, Robert had been in a rail accident that had severed his leg just below the knee. He never accepted pity, and he never let the loss of his leg bother him much. He got around well on his crutch and reminded anyone who felt sorry for him that his future was bright, because one day he'd have both legs again when he made it to heaven. On Friday afternoon, December 23rd, Martha and Sterling left home in a buggy, on their way to Ironton, Ohio, to spend the night with one of Martha's married daughters, Kate Shore. Martha planned to purchase a few small Christmas gifts at the Ironton General Store the next day and return home on Christmas Eve. As she was leaving, Martha saw her friend and neighbor, Carolyn Thomas, and asked if she would allow her daughter, Emma, to stay with Fanny and Robert since she would be away overnight. Carolyn quickly agreed. She knew that Fanny would be alone until Robert returned from work later that evening and would make good company for the other young woman. Emma was Carolyn's daughter from her first marriage, and her last name was officially Carrico, but she often used her stepfather's name of Thomas. Having Emma in the house was a great comfort to Martha, although the arrangement wouldn't have been necessary if she knew where her husband was. John had left Ashland just before Thanksgiving, and his whereabouts at the time were unknown. Shortly after 6 p.m., Emma said goodbye to her mother and went next door to the Gibbons house, where Fanny was waiting for her. The two girls were not only neighbors, but best friends. Carolyn waved goodbye, not knowing it was the last time she would see her daughter alive. On Saturday morning, December 24th, Carolyn woke around 4:30. The house was chilly, so she got out of bed to stoke the fire. She glanced next door at the Gibbons house and saw that it was dark. She needed more wood, so she put on her coat and opened the front door. As she stepped onto the porch, a light caught her eye. It was coming from the Gibbons house, which had been dark just minutes before. It looked as though a lamp was burning in the window. It seemed unusual for the three teenagers to be awake so early, so Carolyn looked a little closer. That was when she realized the light wasn't coming from a lamp. There were flames moving behind the window glass. "Fire!" she cried, and Carolyn ran toward the Gibbons house. Flames were now roaring across the front room, and the window curtains were ablaze. She pounded on the door and screamed for Emma. She tried to turn the knob, but it was locked. She ran to the side door and continued calling for help. Neighbors were starting to emerge from their homes. The side door was unlocked and Carolyn rushed into the house. She could see nothing, though. The smoke was too thick. She yelled for Emma, Fanny, and Robert, but there was no response. Men from the neighborhood, including Joseph Arthur, George Faulkner, John House, John Meade, and others, pulled Carolyn from the burning building and rushed to form a bucket brigade. There was a small stream near the house, but the water was mostly frozen, and precious time was spent trying to retrieve enough water to douse the flames. Well, Carolyn was now frantic, screaming and crying, and trying to make the men understand that her daughter was inside the house, along with two of the Gibbons children. She had to be restrained to keep her from running back into the fire. George Faulkner ran to the upper side of the house and managed to break open the window of Robert's room. He managed to get close enough to see, though, that the room was empty. Robert wasn't in there. He then went to the lower side window next to where Fanny slept and shattered the glass with an axe. He could see something inside, a hand, a dress, a body on the floor. Faulkner let out an audible cry and turned away. So John House pushed past him and took hold of the hand, pulling the body toward the window. He tried to free the unmoving form, but he couldn't. He called for help, and another man reached in to assist him. They lifted the corpse over the window ledge. It was Emma, burned and disfigured. John left the young woman's body and broke open the front door. He charged into the smoke and flames and searched for the Gibbons children. He found Fanny first. He picked her up and handed her out the window to the men outside. After catching a quick breath of clean air, he returned to the burning rooms. Choking on the thick smoke and dodging the crackling flames, he stumbled over an oil can sitting on the floor. Then he found Robert lying with his head under the stairs. He dragged him to the side porch, and Cyrus Wilson helped carry the boy away. By now, a large crowd had gathered. Some fought the fire, while others tried to save what they could of the Gibbons' belongings. A few men tried to rush back in to search for Sterling. It was believed he was still in the house, but eventually they were assured he had left town with his mother. The bodies of Emma, Fanny, and Robert were placed on some soot-covered bedsheets that had been rescued from the house. As the charred and mangled bodies of the teenagers lay on the ground, those gathered around were sickened by the terrible sight and the rancid stench of burned flesh. Carolyn Thomas was out of her mind with grief. This had not been an accidental fire. It had become apparent the three children had been brutalized. They had been murdered. Word began to spread throughout the community, and a crowd gathered, aching for revenge. The police soon arrived at the scene, followed by the Justice of Peace, Thomas Russell, who began to gather a jury for an inquest. Three doctors, J.W. Martin, J.H. Wade, and W.F. Tiernan, were summoned to examine the bodies. A close look at the corpses by detectives revealed Robert's skull had been shattered. Brain matter was seeping from the wound. The skulls of both girls had been crushed. Blood was found on the pillows and bedsheets that survived the blaze. Robert was the least burned of the three of them, and it became clear that the fire began on the bed where the two girls slept. They had been burned almost beyond recognition. More evidence of murder was also found. An axe was discovered under some smoldering pieces of carpet with hair and blood all over its head. A crowbar was seen through a crack in the fence. It was also soaked with blood. It was apparent they had been the murder weapons and hinted at the idea that there might have been more than one assailant. Worst of all, the examinations by the three doctors agreed that both young women had been raped. It seemed clear that the house was set ablaze to destroy evidence of the murders. With Christmas plans and festivities forgotten, a mass meeting was called by community leaders. The entire town was shocked by the hideous crime. The Wheeling Register newspaper called it, quote, one of the most atrocious and hellish murders ever committed in a civilized community. The meeting was a stunning and sobering event. It was held on Christmas Eve afternoon at the Aldine Hotel. Hundreds were in attendance from every neighborhood in town, where they were informed of the murders and rapes, and volunteers were sought for the terrible duty of informing Martha Gibbons about the deaths of her two children. Only 1 year before, she had lost her youngest son, Harry, and now there was fear that her heart might fail when she received more terrible news. A group of five, C.C. Geiger, his wife Margaret, two neighbors, and Dr. Tiernan, volunteered to travel to Ironton that morning and call at the home of Martha's daughter. A motion was then made to offer a reward of $200 for the arrest and conviction of the killers. A committee was formed to raise money to hire a detective to assist the Ashland police. In those days, most police departments, especially in small communities, were not equipped to handle murder investigations, so private detective agencies were usually hired. The main goal of the meeting, though, was to keep the community calm. The killers needed to be apprehended quickly before they could flee the area. The grieving families required assistance, and the town's safety needed to be assured. Officials were urgently trying to prevent vigilante justice. There was already talk of a lynching when the killers were found, and that needed to be stopped. As the day wore on, the reward fund increased to possibly as much as $3,000. Reports vary on that. But a detective named John T. Norris was hired from Cincinnati. He was widely known and had successfully broken up a criminal gang operating in the area 3 years before. But even before Norris arrived, another detective named Alf Burnett from the Eureka Detective Agency in Charleston, West Virginia, showed up in town. He had a great interest in solving the crime and getting the reward money, of course. But he failed at both. The coroner's inquest was held on Christmas Day. The verdict was, quote, murder by person or persons unknown, and a funeral was held on Monday. Even though it had rained all morning, the church was overflowing. The procession to the Ashland Cemetery was the largest in the city's history, with carriages, buggies, wagons, and hundreds of people on foot following the three coffins to the burial ground. Detective Norris arrived in Ashland on the morning of the funerals. He was taken to the crime scene and began to sift through the rubble of the house, looking for clues. He spent the better part of the afternoon interviewing neighbors and anyone who was present during the fire. After gathering as much information as possible, he had a long conversation with Martha Gibbons about her family and her husband. Norris learned that John Gibbons had been absent from their home for more than a month. He also discovered that the axe, the crowbar, and the oil can used in the murders belonged to the Gibbons family, which led him to believe that the killers must have known where the tools were kept. Based on these facts and his interview with Martha, Norris announced to the press that evening that he had solved the crime. The guilty party, he said, was none other than John Gibbons himself. He believed that ongoing family disputes and problems had led to a violent attack on the family. Gibbons had returned to Ashland under the cover of darkness and carried out the dark deeds, mistaking poor Emma for his wife Martha. When the newspapers reported his theory, they also included several stories attributed to Martha Gibbons, suggesting that her estranged husband was dangerously unstable. He was, the rumors claim, subject to spells of temporary insanity, during which he threatened to kill his family, cut their heads off, and burn down the house. On one occasion, he had proposed a suicide pact with his wife. Norris ordered an immediate search for John Gibbons and announced he would soon be in custody if Gibbons hadn't killed himself already. But even while a search for John Gibbons was being organized, it was revealed that the statements attributed to Martha about her husband were wild exaggerations. They were nothing but rumors gathered by an eager reporter, and Martha denied making them. Also, John Gibbons arrived in Ashland on January 2nd, bringing overwhelming proof that he was elsewhere on the night of the murders. He wasn't arrested, and Detective Norris was fired from the case. The investigators were now back to square one. Or so it seemed at first. The Ashland police and the private detectives were not the only ones working on the case. Around the time that John Gibbons arrived back in town, Marshal James Heflin also came to Ashland to try and help with the investigation. Born and raised in Maysville, Kentucky, he'd served in Company H of the 11th Kentucky Cavalry during the Civil War, and in 1872 became the Maysville City Marshal. He was also commissioned as a U.S. Marshal and had been serving Maysville in the state for 16 years at the time of the murders. He was highly respected as a no-nonsense lawman, but had many friends and was well thought of in the area. Heflin didn't buy Norris's theory about John Gibbons and began following a different trail, which led him to a man named George Ellis, who lived near the Gibbons family. According to witnesses, he'd been acting strangely for days and seemed to know things about the murders that he shouldn't. Heflin's interest was piqued, and he had Ellis brought in for questioning. Almost immediately, Ellis started confessing to everything. He admitted he was at the Gibbons home on the night of the murders, but he put most of the blame on two other men, Ellis Craft and William Neal. The three men worked in a brickyard together, and the other men had been bragging that they planned to, quote, carnally know Fanny Gibbons and Emma Thomas before Christmas. He claimed that late on the night of the murders, they woke up Ellis and insisted he go with them to the Gibbons house. When he resisted, he said they threatened him with a gun and forced him to go. He followed reluctantly, and they entered the house through a window. Ellis argued that he only watched as Craft raped Fanny as she cried for help. William Neal then raped Emma as Ellis held down her arms. When it was over, Emma said, "Oh, Will, I know who you are, and I'm going to tell my mother." "No, you won't," Neal said, and struck her on the head with the crowbar. She threw up her hands when she was hit, but died instantly. The noise woke Robert, and he tried to get out of bed to raise the alarm, but Craft hit him in the head with the axe. Craft then killed Fanny, too, leaving her body sprawled across the bed. It had been Craft's idea to burn down the house, and he'd ordered Ellis to find some coal oil. When he refused, Craft threatened to kill him, too. Ellis was then told to pour the oil over the girls' bodies and set them ablaze. Ellis wept as he told this story to Marshal Heflin, who had very little sympathy for him. Even when he added that the cries of the girls for mercy had been so terrible to hear that he hadn't slept since that night. Every minute of the tragedy was so vivid in his mind he couldn't stand it any longer. He told the marshal, quote, "I want to die and would have killed myself but was afraid. All I want is that the guilty parties be punished." Craft and Neal were quickly arrested. They also lived in the same neighborhood as the Gibbons family, and we can imagine the three of them must have frequently seen Fanny and Emma on the streets. Their whispered discussions eventually turned to action, likely spurred on by Ellis Craft, the only one of the three with a criminal record. He had been arrested twice by the Ashland police for disorderly conduct and convicted for what was then called, quote, criminal intercourse with underage girls, three times. He'd also once been charged with shooting a man who came to the defense of his wife after Craft made lewd advances toward her. This upstanding citizen, along with his crony, William Neal, denied everything Ellis said. They knew nothing about the murders, they claimed, and barely knew George Ellis. But no one believed them. The police took the prisoners by steamboat to Catlettsburg. They managed to secure the men in jail before the gathering lynch mob could get them. But everyone believed a lynching was inevitable. The Cincinnati Commercial newspaper said, quote, "Most likely before this is read by the many readers of the Commercial, the hellhounds in this blood-curdling drama will swing into eternity." 10 armed men guarded the prisoners at the Catlettsburg jail as they waited for their trials to begin. Threats of lynch mobs continued until the very day each was taken to the courthouse. All three were charged with aiding, abetting, and conspiring murder. George Ellis was separately charged with 3 counts of murder, a technicality allowing him to testify against his accomplices. William Neal eventually confessed to the crime, but Ellis Craft continued to insist he was innocent. But it didn't matter. All three men were convicted. Neal and Craft were found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to hang. Ellis testified against Neal and Craft and was found guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to life in prison. But this was not a verdict that pleased the people of Ashland. On June 3, 1882, about 40 men in black masks arrived in Catlettsburg, broke into the jail, unlocked Ellis's cell, and hauled him out with a rope around his neck. They returned him to Ashland and took him to the brickyard where he'd once worked, not far from the scene of the murders. The rope was secured to a sycamore tree, his hands were tied behind his back, and he was hauled off his feet to slowly strangle to death. The next morning, the body was still hanging there. A crowd gathered to see the corpse throughout the morning and into the afternoon. He was cut down later that day, and when his father came to claim the body, Ellis was taken away by wagon. And thus, wrote a reporter for the Cincinnati Commercial, closed the last chapter in the life of George Ellis, a poor, confused, tormented soul. Both Neal and Kraft appealed their convictions and were granted new trials and a change of venue to Carter County. They were taken by steamboat to Maysville, guarded by 220 state militia troops. News spread of the escort and crowds of mostly women and children gathered along the river to watch the steamboat pass. 5 miles below Catlettsburg, a gang of about 18 armed men commandeered a ferry filled with passengers and went in pursuit of the steamboat. They chased it down, demanding the prisoners be turned over. A few wild shots were fired in the direction of the steamboat, hitting nothing, which makes the response by the soldiers in return so baffling. Shots rang out in the direction of the ferry, causing all the passengers to run for cover. The initial volley of fire killed one of the attackers and wounded several others. And if the gunfire had stopped with that, the soldiers would have been acting in self-defense, but they continued to shoot. More shots rang out, nearly 1,500 shots in all, toward the ferry boat and toward the people gathered along the riverbank to watch. Bullets ripped into carriages, houses, train depot, and people. They fell in every direction. 5 people on shore were killed and another 21 were seriously injured. It wasn't until the steamboat was out of range that the gunfire finally stopped. The shots from the ferry, well, they'd grazed 2 soldiers on board the steamboat. The following trials didn't turn out to be worth the blood spilled that day. Neither Kraft nor Neal succeeded in their second effort to escape justice. Both were convicted again to first-degree murder and sentenced to hang. Ellis Kraft went to the gallows on October 12, 1883, in front of a large and festive crowd in Grayson, Kentucky. As the noose dangled behind him, he declared his innocence once again. After he finished speaking, he sang a hymn and made a tearful prayer. The trapdoor beneath his feet sprung at 1:15 p.m., and Ellis Kraft plunged to his death. William Neal also now claimed he was innocent. He was finally brought to trial in 1884, and it was basically a rehash of his first trial, with the same result. During the proceedings, Martha Gibbons was called to the witness stand. Her testimony brought tears to nearly everyone in the courtroom, including the jury. As she left the courthouse that day, Martha told a reporter that she hoped this would be the last trial for which she would be called as a witness. "It is killing me," she said. On March 27, 1885, Neal was brought to Grayson and prepared for execution. He climbed to the steps of the gallows and, like Kraft, claimed he was innocent. A minister began reading from the Bible, but Neal just cut him off. "I bid you one and all farewell," he said. The black hood was placed over his head, and the last of the 3 killers met his end. Justice had finally come for Robert and Fanny Gibbons and Emma Thomas. Their deaths had been avenged, but it's doubtful they cared, and likely neither did their grieving families. They could rest easily because the 3 terrible men were no longer walking the streets, but their executions certainly didn't bring back the children they'd lost. The Christmas holidays would never be the same for those families, or for the people of Ashland, ever again. Thanks for staying tuned to this episode, and if you liked it, give me just a couple of more minutes to list some of the upcoming news and announcements we have. First, I'd like to say thank you again to all of you who showed up on December 20th to help us get the American Oddities Museum move from the Mineral Springs to our new location at the Snyder Building in downtown Alton, Illinois. Despite all the hard work and the amount of stuff that had to be moved, it was a fun day and wouldn't have been possible without all of you. So, thanks again. Also, mark your calendar for January 17th when we'll be holding our grand reopening celebration at the new place. Our first event will be held the following weekend in Alton Seance, followed by our first dinner, The Devil Came to St. Louis, on January 31st. You can find all the information about all of that at dinnerandspirits.com. Before that, though, tickets will be going on sale for the 2026 Haunted America Conference on January 12th. The website is available now at ghostconference.net, and you can check it out to see this year's roster of speakers and presenters, after hours events, tours, ghost hunts, workshops, and everything else you need to know. Vendor spaces are now on sale for 2026. They're available right as we speak, and we're already half filled for this year. So if you're hoping to have a vendor booth this time around, you don't want to wait too long to get that booked. And finally, our annual Dead of Winter food drive is coming up on February 7th. As many of you know, this is a free daytime event with a donation of canned goods, foods, and non-perishable items for local food banks. This is our 27th annual event, and we'd love to make this our biggest year so far. We're partnering with Franklin Lodge in Alton, where the daytime events and ticketed after-hour events will be held. And speaking of those, they are filling up fast. We have a Black Mirror workshop, a ghost hunt at Franklin Lodge, and a Devil Came to St. Louis dinner event with me. Those do require a reservation, and a portion of the proceeds from each also goes to help the hungry in the region. We also have a special VIP event that's being held at the new American Oddities Museum on Friday night, February 6th. That's the night before Dead of Winter. And those guests will receive one of the limited edition shirts for this year. However, we do have a deadline to sign up for that because we have to order the shirts. So if you'd like to attend the VIP event, you have until January 5th to sign up. And now with that, I'd like to say thanks again for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows in the network and recommend them to family and friends, people you work with, anyone you think would love it too. If you have thoughts or comments about American Nightmares, leave us a review or text your comments to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. And as a thank you, you'll get a discount code. That's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events when you purchase from our online store. Because, well, remember, in addition to our podcast network, we also have books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And you can find everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net. We appreciate your continued support for every aspect of American Hauntings. We couldn't and wouldn't do this without all of you, and your comments and your feedback mean a lot to us. So good night, good luck, and Merry Christmas, or Happy Hanukkah, or Yule, or Saturnalia, or Kwanzaa, or anything else you celebrate, or maybe nothing that you celebrate. Regardless, we hope you have a happy and safe one, and, well, one that's maybe just a little bit scary, too.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters' 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.